Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The 2020 legislative session in Annapolis will look much like the one a year ago, with virtual hearings, masking, and distancing. The 90-day session begins tomorrow. As Omicron infections surge, pandemic relief remains a priority, as do crime, climate change, and redrawing the districts of the 188 members of the General Assembly. Joining me for a preview of the session is Pamela Wood, state politics reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Danielle Gaines, editor of the news site Maryland Matters. Welcome back, Danielle.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yesterday, Governor Hogan announced some legislative proposals focused on criminal justice. Here's part of what he said.
Today, I am again strongly urging the leaders of the city and in the legislature to put all of the politics aside and to work with us to finally pass these emergency crime bills. There can be no more excuses and no more delays. The time for action is now.
He plans to reintroduce two pieces of legislation, the Judicial Transparency Act and the Violent Firearms Offender Act. Pamela, what would these bills do?
These bills we've seen a few times before in Annapolis, and they have not been passed. One bill would increase certain sentences, criminal penalties for crimes committed with guns. That's the Violent Offender Act. The other one would require an annual report on the sentences that are handed down by judges in violent crimes. There's some concern that maybe judges are the ones who are too lenient and maybe letting people out too soon. So that's a push for transparency. The sentencing bill on the gun crimes has gotten some traction in the Senate in past years, but has not gone anywhere in the House. We'll see if that gets consideration this year. The one on the reporting on sentencing, the House of Delegates Speaker Adrian Jones created a work group to look at this issue. So that might get some more consideration than usual. The governor also announced again his refund the police effort and wants to put even more additional funding into various police programs as well.
Pamela, Governor Hogan and Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby have butted heads over the city's persistent homicides. The governor demanded statistics on how often her office chooses not to prosecute cases or offers plea deals. How might this squabble affect the city's funding?
Well, I'm not sure how it would affect funding in particular, because this governor wants to show that he offers financial support for police and putting criminals behind bars. But a lot of people talk about the need to have a coordinated effort from, you know, the city, the state, in combating violent crime in multiple ways. And when you have a governor and a chief prosecutor who basically don't even speak to each other except for leveling accusations at press conferences, I'm not sure how that helps create the solutions or coming to agreements on how best to attack this really persistent, difficult problem in Baltimore. The governor was asked at his press conference about whether he would meet with State's Attorney Mosby, and he said he has no interest in meeting with her.
Danielle, the Refund the Police initiative that Pamela mentioned, Governor Hogan first announced that in October. It's grown into a $500 million three-year plan to support state and local police agencies. What have you heard from Democratic lawmakers about this initiative?
I think the general response was that police agencies haven't seen their funding cut. So it's kind of a non-issue, but that, you know, Democratic lawmakers do want to see funding directed in other ways, to community programs, to violence intervention programs, to programs that can just kind of help overall improve the quality of life, and to kind of address crime control and prevention that way.
This is On the Record. On WIPR, I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Maryland Matters editor Danielle Gaines and Baltimore Sun Politics reporter Pamela Wood about the issues lawmakers will tackle in the legislative session that begins tomorrow. The state has a huge surplus, like $6 billion. What does the governor want to do with it, and what are legislators talking about? And I should disclose that my husband, Jim Rosapep, is a Democratic state senator. He's vice chair of the Budget and Tax Committee.
Yeah, well, you had the governor obviously reiterate his desire for some of that to go to anti-crime efforts and to refund the police. He's also interested in tax relief programs, including tax relief for retirees. The administration has made some commitment to increases for state employees through the collective bargaining process. And I think there's some general agreement between the governor's office and state lawmakers about providing more COVID relief, so assistance for folks who've been hardest hit during this pandemic. You have a lot of consensus also around saving some of this money and not having it all spent right away. A legislative advisory panel has recommended that some of the money goes to state building and state park maintenance, capital projects at state colleges. But when you talk about using some of this money, you also have additional pandemic pressures. So the cost of construction is particularly high right now. So it kind of remains to be seen how far this could ultimately go.
And if I could add, there's really kind of a push and pull here. You could go two ways with this extra money. You could do one-time costs. So, you know, improvements to state parks, improvements to schools, those construction projects, or short-term pandemic financial aid, or you could do long-term spending. And that's where the tax cuts or tax relief would come in. And there is a reluctance among Democratic leaders to consign the state to multiple years out of losing money, because while they're flush with cash now from federal aid and for the next few years, that's not going to last in perpetuity. So they are cognizant of trying to be responsible with how they spend that money. But we're expecting to hear soon from the governor what exactly he wants to do and how much tax relief he's going to seek as part of this.
Pamela, Governor Hogan is facing questions about his administration's use of an app that deletes messages. How is Governor Hogan using this app, Wicker?
Yeah, our colleagues over at the Washington Post had an excellent story about Wicker, which I think a lot of us had heard about or suspected. This is a messaging app. You can set it so it deletes messages after an hour, after a day, after a certain amount of time. The concern is that, is the governor and his staff, are they conducting state business on this app and there's not a record of it? Because we have public records laws that require emails, text messages, memos to be retained so we can understand how our government is working. There is some talk that there may be legislation to address this. The governor, for his part, I asked him the other day, he thinks it's totally fine and there's not a problem. And he says he's quite transparent.
Yeah. The governor's spokesman told the Washington Post that these are kind of news of the day conversations and just kind of fleeting, jovial discussions. But the Washington Post report noted that some of the conversations had to do with the controversial purchase of COVID testing kits from South Korea, and that there were other kind of issues of public interest being discussed on the app. Interestingly, the governor's office has said that one of the reasons has said that they're not subject to the public information law because they aren't a unit of state government. They are the head of state government. And so that's one of the areas that you can expect to see lawmakers legislating to better define that.
And of course, the pandemic continues to disrupt daily life. Pamela, what kinds of COVID relief bills are you anticipating?
Yeah, we've seen a lot of proposals, a lot of ideas, but nothing firm yet. Certainly Comptroller Peter Francia, who's running for governor. Obviously, he has a voice, but not a role here in the state house in legislating. But he's suggested there should be checks to every Marylander. There's some discussion of targeted business relief, as we saw beforehand, you know, grants and loans to keep businesses going who are affected by it. So it remains to be seen exactly what we'll see.
And I think there's also going to be, related to the pandemic, a real push for additional housing protections this year. That's an issue that kind of failed in the final hours of the 2021 session, but lawmakers were able to create some kind of outlines for when renters should have legal assistance in court. And I think they're going to look to shore that up and to fund legal assistance programs that would make that more of a reality. And the way that they would seek to do that is by raising Maryland's evictions fees, which are quite low compared to other areas.
The idea there would be both to pay for representation for tenants and to discourage landlords from filing eviction cases?
Yeah. You know, Attorney General Brian Frosch said, you know, before the pandemic, Maryland had a serial eviction filing problem because the cost for landlords to get into court is so low. And then additionally, the success rate for landlords in court is so high compared to the success rate of tenants. So this would look to kind of curb an issue from two different angles.
We need to take a quick break in this preview of the 2022 legislative session. Maryland Matters editor Daniel Gaines and Baltimore Sun Politics reporter Pamela Wood are with us. When we're back, what ideas are percolating in Annapolis about how to address climate change? I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. 90 days, that's all the time lawmakers have to address the state's aspirations and troubles, the economic potential of legalized cannabis, mounting concern about the warming climate, the fallout of the pandemic, and myriad other issues. With some insights into what legislators are thinking, my guests this morning are Maryland Matters editor Danielle Gaines and Baltimore Sun Politics reporter Pamela Wood. Pamela, which lawmakers are leading the push for legalizing recreational marijuana?
Well, so many lawmakers actually have come on board. There's very few outright opponents of legalizing marijuana for recreational use by adults. Of course, we're going to see a lot of work from the heads of the committees that will handle this, House Judiciary Committee led by Delegate Luke Klippinger and Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee led by State Senator Will Smith. It's going to be a big discussion this year, and there's momentum to move this forward. A lot of questions about details of how to get it done. When you legalize something like marijuana, there are actually hundreds of different things that have to happen along with it. And that's going to take a lot of focus of lawmakers this year.
And you do have some split opinion in whether or not the General Assembly should outright pass a legalization bill or whether they should send this to referendum of the voters.
House Speaker Adrian Jones wants it to go to referendum, but that doesn't necessarily preclude also working out a regulatory scheme, right?
Yeah, that's the question of really, if it goes to referendum, which is, you know, appears to be a lot of momentum for that, and then voters would have their say in November, do we legalize or not in the state of Maryland? But the question is, what do you send to the voters in November? Do you send a general question, which is what happened with expanding sports betting, or do you work out all of the framework, the taxation, the licensing, the criminal justice changes, work that all out now and send that to voters in November, or give the general question and work it out in 2023, which would make implementation longer? That's one of the sticky issues, basically how to go about doing it.
Danielle, a package of environmental legislation failed to pass last year. Lawmakers and advocates are expected to circle back this year. What should we expect?
Yeah, I think, you know, the final hours of the session last year, there was a lot of, it felt normal. There was a lot of running around between chambers and last minute negotiation between lawmakers, partly on climate change. And ultimately, you know, an omnibus bill didn't pass last session, but there is consensus among the leaders of the environmental committees to get something done to pass comprehensive climate change legislation this year. The broad goals would be to include aggressive cuts to greenhouse gas emissions, to boost electric vehicle infrastructure in the state, to implement more stringent green building standards, and also all of this kind of setting environmental justice as a priority. So they are working together. There are still some differences. The House has again shown a preference for multiple bills to accomplish this, while the Senate is showing a preference for kind of one big measure. But both of the chairman of those committees, Senator Paul Pinsky and Delegate Kumar Barve, have said that they want to move quickly because this is one of the issues that is kind of on the list of items being considered for quick passage so the lawmakers could have an in-session veto override if necessary. Anything that's vetoed after the legislative session this year couldn't be overridden in 2023 by a new legislature, so it would have to start from scratch.
That's Danielle Gaines, editor of Maryland Matters, here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about issues the legislature is expected to take up in the session that begins tomorrow. And also with us is state politics reporter Pamela Wood of the Baltimore Sun. So, Pamela, legislators voted to adopt a new congressional district map during their special session in December. This new map is already facing legal challenges, right?
That's right. There already have been two different lawsuits filed challenging the map. Now, they face questionable odds in the courts as the prior map from 10 years ago, which a lot of people would think was worse, survived legal challenges. And this new map is sort of based off of that map, tweaked. Supporters of it say they've tweaked it for the better. But there are two lawsuits. We expect them to move quickly because the filing deadline for people who want to run for Congress is February 22nd. So a lot of people are waiting to see what happens. Decisions have to be made. What district do I run in? What district even do I live in? So we're following those two cases that are both filed in Anne Arundel County Circuit Court.
That's about the congressional districts. Danielle, the legislature must also redraw the lines of its own legislative districts to reflect the census. Its commission has agreed on a starting proposal. What are the major changes on this proposed map?
Yeah, so the Legislative Redistricting Advisory Commission proposal, which, you know, should be considered to hold a lot of sway as that panel's proposal did during the congressional redistricting process. In general, you know, it accounts for population changes throughout the state. So it results in one less Senate seat for the city of Baltimore, which lost population in the 2020 census. It extends a Western Maryland district further east because you need enough people to fill up a whole district. It kind of shores up some Democratic districts throughout the state, including District 9, which currently runs in Howard County and Carroll County. That would instead run from Howard County and potentially increase the legislation by cutting into northern Montgomery County.
So when you say it shores up some Democratic districts, does it then make it more likely that the Democrats would hold on to a veto-proof majority?
I think it's likely that they would be able to hold on to that majority. It does also, you know, sometimes when you're shoring up Democratic districts, it also shores up Republican districts. So there are some sitting Republican lawmakers who are also happy with the contours of this map and what it might mean for their election chances.
And real briefly, how does this process of drawing their own lines, how does the process work? There's this proposed map, now what?
Yeah, for the legislative districts, I believe technically in the state constitution, it says that the governor has to introduce a proposal. And then the General Assembly has 45 days to change or alter that proposal. And if they don't pass something within 45 days, then the governor's plan would take effect. You know, you can wholesale replace one map with another through amendment. So I anticipate that that won't be a problem. And this is something that should be done, you know, within the first half of the legislative session and may also face legal challenges, which is common.
And if I could add, the governor does have his proposal already. He appointed a committee comprised of Republicans, Democrats, and independents months ago. They drew up their own map of these state Senate and delegate districts. So that's out there. He's going to introduce that on the first day of session, but don't expect that to really go anywhere. It's going to be this map moving forward from Democratic leadership that's going to be the basis for what they pass this year.
Many people expect that the U.S. Supreme Court will overturn the abortion ruling Roe versus Wade. Maryland has codified the protections of Roe v. Wade into law. But Pamela, is there something the legislature might do on this issue?
That's right, Sheila. Back in the 1990s, it was put into Maryland's law, basically codifying the protections in Roe v. Wade. Over the past few years, there's been discussion about maybe further strengthening that through an amendment to the state constitution. That's looking less likely, but certainly advocates for access to abortion care are talking about ways that they can shore up that access for Maryland residents. And of course, we expect that the anti-abortion advocates will be vocal as well in trying to get more restrictions.
Pamela, how do you think June's primary election will color this legislative session?
I think the upcoming election does have a major factor because as delegates and senators are making their decisions and voting on bills, they know that they have to turn right around and defend those to people who are just about to vote for them in just a few weeks. The primary election is in June, concluding with Election Day on June 28th. So there's not a lot of time for people to forget bad votes or votes they don't like. So and on the flip side, you might see lawmakers trying to really get something passed or really make a splash with what they're trying to do, knowing that voters might actually be paying attention now more than they did last year or the year before.
Danielle?
I think another really interesting factor in that regard, too, is the fact that there's video streaming of the chamber floor sessions now. I know after the special session, you know, last year we saw like a little bit more video on lawmakers' Facebook pages of their floor speeches and stuff. And I just noticed after the special session in December, it seemed like I couldn't scroll through Facebook without hitting a lawmaker's video of themselves giving a speech from the House or the Senate floor. So that's an interesting new dynamic that hasn't existed before in Maryland election years.
It's a great way for lawmakers to say, hey, look at me. See, I'm fighting for you. Look at this video clip. So are we going to get even more protracted floor debates with people trying to make a show of what they're doing and play to the cameras? We'll see.
Well, then another piece of the dynamic, though, is that this is the last legislative session of Governor Hogan. He can't succeed himself as governor. How does that affect things?
I honestly am not sure how much because the governor, frankly, hasn't proven to be a huge factor because his proposals, the vast majority of them just routinely don't pass. You know, he might get a little traction on the crime bills this year. Of course, he has control over the budget, and that's always a big item. But, you know, it remains to be seen if he makes more of an effort. This governor also has a policy not to come down and testify before lawmakers, whereas other governors selectively have pushed for their biggest priorities by going in person and making a plea and a debate before them. But this governor has chosen not to do that. So he's, you know, seldom seen in the halls of the House and Senate office buildings here.
Well, I'm grateful to you both for this conversation. I learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Pamela Wood covers state politics for the Baltimore Sun. Danielle Gaines is editor of the news site Maryland Matters. You can find links to more coverage of the General Assembly at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you're with us on the record. Come back tomorrow.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.